Welcome to the Women for Election podcast. Today, we're going to be hearing from Samantha Power, who's chatting with Darvel MacDonald. Samantha's going to talk to us about her book, Education of an Idealist, as well as talking through her life and career to date, moving as an immigrant from Ireland, her work within the White House on the Obama campaigns, and also then as US ambassador to the UN. She also talks about Women for Election and the importance of a network like Women for Election. You'll find this podcast wherever you find your podcasts. You can also find us on all of our social media channels. And as always, if you can donate, please do so on womenforelection.ie. So, welcome everyone. Delighted you could all join us for our second In Conversation series. And with two brilliant, brilliant women who are both great friends of Women for Election as well. Ambassador Samantha Power doesn't really need any introduction, but I'm going to do one anyway. She emigrated from Ireland to the US, where she, grew up through the American system, but with that dual identity in terms of being able to link into her Irish background as well. As a migrant, she then went on to study. She's a law graduate. She picked up a Pulitzer Prize along the way. She is a journalist, a former presidential advisor, a diplomat, and I suppose most well known for her role as a US ambassador to the UN, and is now a professor in Harvard Law School. She, of course, as well is, as I mentioned when she spoke in Women for Election previously, is an adopted Kerry woman as well. She is going to be chatting with Darvel MacDonald, who many of you know, who's also a great friend of Women for Election. Darvel, too, is a law graduate, a journalist, an author, and a broadcaster, and I suppose an all-round brilliant woman as well. I promise I keep my introductions brief, but I do want to say, before we get into the chat, just to thank both of you for coming along this evening. It's been hugely popular. I know we were we had to upgrade our package to ensure that all of those who registered could participate, because so many were interested in joining us and hearing the conversation this evening. So thank you both very, very much. I'm sure all of us are very much looking forward to this evening. And I suppose your book, Samantha, so much of it echoed with so many of us in terms of the challenges in the halls of power, even the things like, I suppose, being discreet about pregnancy in the early stages, the finding out that some of your male colleagues were being paid more, all of those challenges there that echo with so many of us in very different roles in life, but those same challenges echo with so many of us. So with that, I'll hand over to both of you. I'm very much look forward to the chat this evening.
Fantastic. Well, hello, everyone. Welcome to the North Dublin studios of Women for Election. If you hear my neighbours, if the lawnmowers and everything go off, don't blame me. But Samantha Power, you are very, 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 very welcome. I don't need to rehearse your introduction, only to add that in addition to all your accolades, you are unmistakably one of our own. Our flame herd, sports mad Dubliner, with a very, very incredibly familiar, in many respects, Irish backstory. And today we're going to be talking about it all. Love, loss, luck, wins and loses, life in the public domain. But I'm just wondering, what does it take to get to meet you? I'll just explain to everyone. Last year, in a sort of sliding doors moment, I collided with Samantha Power. The following night, we were both on the bill for Kilconomics, and I missed her. I did manage to get hold of you for my BBC programme last year by phone. And now I get to see you on video, and I'm just wondering, what will it take for us to finally meet?
A vaccine? For starters? No, I'm kidding. But that, it might take a vaccine for me to get over the pond anytime soon. But I'd love to meet in person. We'll make that happen.
We'll get there. And look, I'm going to get straight in because I don't know if you can see this. This is my version of your book. And I have so many questions.
Aww.
So have so many people who have emailed in and have been in contact with me. So I'm going to ask you, first of all, how are you handling life in lockdown? Are you homeschooling?
Do you want my fake answer or my real answer?
Give us both.
No. I mean, on one level, you know, it's very hard to feel sorry for myself. I'm an academic now, you know, not in the government. So I had a teaching schedule until very recently. I was teaching three courses at Harvard University. We went right to Zoom. I had less performance anxiety because I was just doing it from the comfort of my backyard. As a person who, as you read, you know, felt as if, even though I don't regret a day of public service, that I didn't have the balance quite right with my kids and didn't see enough of them. It's been amazing. I mean, just the constancy, right? I said to Declan at one point, I said, it just struck me that he was seeming kind of a little more zen. And I said, this is so weird. You know, this is a time of such fear and concern about, you know, this really big thing that you've never heard of or dealt with before in your young life. And yet you kind of probably have never felt safer. And he just, without even like asking me to elaborate, he said, "Mommy, you can't leave. They won't let you. You can't fly anywhere." In his conception of things, the airplanes aren't going anywhere anymore. They can't be going, or my mother would be on one. Anyway, so that's been amazing, but it is hard. So I, even though I have that perspective, I've been very lucky. We had a very, very bad case of the COVID here in the close family and got through it. And so thus have the antibodies now. And so we feel, you know, doubly lucky. But we, the homeschooling is kicking my ass. I'm bad at it. I teach, you know, Harvard graduate students, Harvard undergraduates, and I have no authority. I might as well be, you know, whistling in the wind for the likelihood of my children listening to me. And I'm going out of my mind is the short answer. But I know I shouldn't be. I should be savoring the dimensions of it that I do notice and do cherish. But man, the homeschooling plus full-time job, you know, I know the women on this call, some of you have it figured out, but I'm not one of them.
I wonder how many. There was a piece in the New York Times, Samantha, which said that nearly half of men say they do most of the homeschooling. 3% of women agree. Is this pandemic going to make things more equal between men, women and men in the home? Or do you think it's going to kind of...
Finish the sentence. It's now legal in Ireland, right? I wouldn't be in America if divorce had been legal in Ireland, you know, a lot of years ago. But... I don't know. It's gonna widen the pre-existing fissures, and it's gonna bring some people closer. It just has a massively disparate impact on men and women. And again, I'd be interested in whether there's any divergence between our two countries in terms of both the actual workload of homeschooling and housework. Unpaid care of all kinds, but it is interesting both what is the actual distribution and then what are perceptions of the distribution. I'd be really interested if there's any, but I bet it's very, very...
My last webinar is anything to go by. It's leading to a number of heated and challenging discussions in the home. You mentioned earlier that, you know, for your children, for Declan and Rian, this is sort of unprecedented, but in fact... For Declan, he has some knowledge of a previous pandemic, right? Because he is like, are you going to where the Ebola is? You have had previous direct experience as a senior person at global and national security of a pandemic. How different is it now?
Can I just say one last thing on your prior question? Mm-hmm. But just the culmination of one of my arguments with my beloved husband, who's really grown and is evolving. But perhaps the precipitant for the evolution was, I didn't marry Don Draper. that was the lowest blow I could strike. But there've been some adjustments which are welcome. And I suppose that's the best we can do is evolve and grow together in this. But yes, both my husband and Declan, my daughter was too young, Rian was too young then, but dealt with the abstraction of the Ebola epidemic as it related to their wife and mother. In 2014, it struck. It went, by the time that it reached the highest levels of the U.S. government and we were really debating in earnest what more we should do, the projections were that 1.4 million people were going to be infected within a matter of about 4 months. President Obama had never been sort of more honored to work with him because the polling, the domestic political polling on it was horrible. Republicans and Democrats alike really succumbing to a very legitimate fear and then also to fear-mongering by then reality TV star Donald Trump, who really made a political name for himself over Ebola in a way that many people have forgotten. Like, this was actually kind of his coming out politically, because he'd been seen again more as an entertainer and a businessman before. But he was tweeting like crazy, fear-mongering like crazy, and it worked. So the legitimate fear was that it was in West Africa, it was spreading like wildfire in West Africa, in Liberia, Guinea, and Sierra Leone. The legitimate fear was it would come on a plane and begin to infect American communities. And the fears were very real, I know, in Europe as well. So Obama, again, amazingly said, we're not going to be safe from this here, ultimately, if we don't deal with it at its source. And as a matter of sort of leading the world in the face of a massive humanitarian crisis, we should lead even if that weren't true. But it is true, we're connected, and we have humanitarian responsibilities. And so he sent 3,000 troops and health workers into West Africa. My job, you know, he was the big boss and made the very hard calls, especially as he was just a couple months in advance of a midterm election. The midterm election, his second term, fell just at the height with the height of Ebola infections, and he didn't let that affect his calculus. Had he, I think he would have fared better, or Democrats would have fared better in the midterm. But he went forth, and the amazing thing as UN ambassador, which is so instructive for today, is this is how the international system works when it works. And we can all cite chapter and verse of when it doesn't work, but it works this way. It's not when someone steps up to be the world's policeman, that almost never works, but when someone steps up to be a kind of catalytic team captain of sorts, or at least a first mover, and then leverages what that major power is doing to try to get others to do more. And of course, over the last 75 years, when it has worked, it has tended to be the US. This is what happened with the Paris Climate Agreement as well. After years of being laggard, it was the U.S. that went to China and did that first bilateral agreement that then was expanded on, and I'm not claiming points on climate by any means as an American, but it was, in terms of how do you build an international agreement, I call it a kind of blob theory. You start with a small number of actors and then it kind of expands outward rather than a collective scrum. It just would never work, no more than it would work in any group dynamic. So that's what's been missing up to now on the pandemic as it relates to developing countries. Those worst case scenarios in Ebola didn't come to pass because the U.S. was able to leverage its commitment to get the United Kingdom to take leadership in Sierra Leone, France, and Guinea.
Look, Samantha, when you look, and you've just mentioned three countries there, like, I mean, many will look back at Ebola and say that was a high point of the Obama administration. You look now at the US response both domestically, and you look at the number of deaths. You also look to the UK as well, which is now the highest level of excess mortality anywhere in Europe. And, you know, Britain and the US came together at that point. They led this very, very strong coalition in the name of kind of a common global public health security. And this sort of wave of confidence sort of went around the UN. And you look now, and when people look outside to the US, they're questioning the US's leadership because of its response both at home and abroad.
You said, I mean, the US is leading the world in infections and deaths. But I would note one common feature in the US and the UK, and the others have delved into this more than I will, but you know, when you think of Donald Trump's predispositions, right, great skepticism about technocratic expertise, hostility to science, hostility to international cooperation and alliances. I mean, could you think of qualities that you would want less in a leader. I should add a lack of tolerance for dissent, dissenting viewpoints. So put aside whether it's expertise or science, but actual just not liking checks and balances, really wanting to be freed of oversight, as you see with all the firings of inspector generals and firings of people who challenge him in his inner circle. So it's if you honestly wrote a Hollywood movie and wrote the script of who it was, who was in place to manage the most significant health crisis in more than 100 years, nobody would buy the script because it would just seem like a ludicrous proposition.
Yes, Samantha Power, and we'll move on to Trump next, but you know, one of the questions, you should see, I have a little waterfall to my right-hand side because there are so many questions coming in. One of the questions is, do you believe that President Trump's poor handling of COVID will end his presidency? I want you to hold that thought.
Sure.
One of the good things, and I know that you speak passionately about this, is the examples of strong leadership in the face of the pandemic. We look to New Zealand, Germany, to Taiwan, Iceland, Norway. And is it any surprise that these countries are led by women? Does it make a difference?
I love this. I love that question. first of all, I don't think it should surprise people that, and it's a longer list even than the one that you read, right? It's actually really, really striking. But if you think about it, you all on this call know way better than I do because you've actually thrown or contemplating throwing your hat in the ring in terms of politics and running for something. But think of what it takes for a woman to reach those heights, right? I mean, what kind of skill set and power of adaptation and ability to combine rigor and empathy and, you know, to be a winning Paul and glad handler on the one hand, but able to also strategize. And I mean, these women, to be in these roles, there's a reason. There's so many obstacles in the way at so many levels and so few role models in most of those countries for those women to be doing what they're doing. These are kick-ass women to begin with. And so as it happens, when you have women who bring that combination of qualities, the combination required to get to that place, probably not a huge surprise, even if it's a welcome development, that they are faring well, welcoming dissent, valuing evidence, willing to change course when things aren't working, humanizing, you know, Jacinda Ardern having press conferences for children. I mean, it's just not something a man either would think of, or most men anyway would think of, or would execute because they'd be afraid it would be politically costly. Can I say one other thing, though, before you cut me off? I know we have a lot of questions, and I know I'm too. When you're alone and somebody calls and they want to talk, you can go on too long. But I wanted to stress one additional thing, which is one of the more painful sort of dimensions of being the only woman on the UN Security Council in 2015 and 2016 for much of the time. And I wrote about this, I think, in the book, but was seeing the school tours come in to the gallery at the UN Security Council and look down at the famous horseshoe table and see one woman with 14 men in 2015, 2016. I mean, you know, and Nikki Haley, by the way, my successor, had the same circumstance. The United Kingdom at that point had never had a female ambassador. Russia, China, France, never. To this day, but I would often think to myself, what are they thinking? Like, what are the boys and the girls like? How are their expectations colored? Well, imagine now in the countries that are led by women, but also all around the world, what it means. This is the Winston Churchill. This is like the bombing of Britain moment for so many countries where the, we know, right, where the fear is there, where the economic hardship is there. And as these women steward their countries to the other side of this crisis, and we're by no means out of the woods because of the economic toll, even if they've contained the public health calamity, imagine how that's going to shape not only the aspirations of girls and the expectations of boys, but also the understanding of what leadership should be altogether for all of us, whoever's in power. And so, you know, I just wanted to add that.
Yeah, one of the questions, because it sort of segues nicely into the big election that's going to be happening in the US this year. But one of the things we regularly discuss about here at Women for Election and more generally in Ireland is the conversion of female participation. So we have had two you know, very, you know, internationally recognized referenda affecting women and equality. We've had our marriage equality referendum. We had our abortion referendum. And we saw outstanding levels of female activism and allyship with women during that time. And, you know, a little bit disappointing in our own recent elections that maybe we didn't convert to the numbers we hoped we might. And I look now at coming into the 2020 election, and I know you're supporting former Vice President Joe Biden. I'll chat to you about that. But it's the last man standing all over again. And I just wonder what was it that we didn't get in the US? How did that sort of pink or female wave not convert into a female candidate?
This time around?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, so you can look at this glass half full, glass half empty. If you look back to 2016, on the one hand, you can think, gosh, if Hillary Clinton, with everything she brought to bear, name recognition, global celebrity, having been Secretary of State, if you know, substantial advantages also in polling for much of the, I think just, that was a devastating blow to people's sense of whether this could ever happen. So you can look at it that way, and you can look at this pool then getting winnowed down again to a older white male and be tempted to think the same thing. On the other way to look at it is, you know, but for Russia's flood of misinformation, but for maybe Jim Comey and some of his late-breaking moves, and we don't want to do the forensics on the 2016 election, not to cry over spilled milk, but for Hillary's own, I think what she would say, some of the decisions she made that she wishes she hadn't made in terms of where to campaign and maybe too great a complacency because of the polling. But she came 78,000 votes away from being president, 78,000 votes spread across three states. So most of them, the margin was 17,000, 20,000, you know, Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Wisconsin. So it's not as if there's like the glass ceiling and then women are, you know, somewhere, you know, in the basement. I mean, we're talking about, and that was in an election, I would note, where 7% of Obama voters from 2012 stayed home, in part because of the polls, in part because of voter suppression, you know, a lot to say on that. And I think voted for third party candidates, millions of votes in play. And it's an election where fewer women voted than voted in 2012, if you can believe it. So 78,000 votes against the backdrop of tens of millions of votes cast and millions of votes not cast is excruciating because it's the one that got away. In this race, you know, you had Elizabeth Warren, Amy Klobuchar, Kamala Harris, Tulsi Gabbard, you know, I'm forgetting, I'm sure a million other people, but I mean, the pool of women who were in the race, like nothing we've ever seen before and completely normalized, right? No sense. I mean, to the degree that any one of them didn't, well, given that, you know, one of them prevailed to the very end, you know, other than with Elizabeth Warren, you know, it's hard to see it as gender as such, insofar, and this is maybe too inside baseball, but the way our primary process works, you know, Iowa was a tough state for Kamala Harris without the name recognition that this and that, you know, New Hampshire was a good state for Amy Klobuchar, but she'd lost the momentum and hadn't cultivated an African-American because she'd invested so much in New Hampshire. So we can explain away the fact that it never happens in a way that's a false alibi, which I don't mean to do, but I do think we're now going to have a vice presidential candidate who's going to be one of these women who performed probably one of these women in the pool or an amazing, there are a couple other stalking horses out there, you know, from elected office elsewhere. And I do think Hillary has, you know, moved us just that much closer, and it's going to happen. Now we think it's normal to elect an African-American president. And if you had told me that, you know, 10, 12 years ago, again, you would have thought that was, or however long ago it was, I guess 15 years ago, you would have thought that was a pipe dream. But we're so much closer in this domain. But women have to vote. We can't have another, and it has to be much more like 2018 midterms in terms of women's involvement and activation. And I think given that Roe v. Wade is hanging in the balance now, and the mm-hmm. pandemic is just the latest reminder of that, because Ruth Bader Ginsburg, of course, you know, had became ill, you know, during the pandemic, and you know, with that, so much already the court is 5-4 in a very inauspicious direction for women's right to choose. And Ginsburg, of course, just the fourth vote, but potentially, but to lose that vote, you know, I think the stakes are very, very clear now that we've had 3.5 years to see what Trump is doing with judges and so forth on issues related to women.
And look, let's talk just briefly about your former boss. I'm not going to get into the substantives of Obamagate because I've tried and looked and I don't really understand what it is. So forgive my lack of understanding on it. But it's more the question of how is somebody who is not running has become the focal point for President Donald Trump in terms of he is the favorite target. He is the person that he most fires off against. Is he a proxy target for who's coming behind him, Vice President Joe Biden, in terms of the candidate? Or what is it about this man that triggers Donald Trump so much?
It's a great question. You know, I'd have to lie down, or some Donald Trump himself would have to lie down and really sort of mine the recesses of his psyche, because it didn't begin with Joe Biden's nomination as the vice president by any means. Donald Trump is obsessed with Barack Obama. The only formula one can use to predict what Donald Trump is going to do on a given day or around a specific policy issue is if Barack Obama was for it, he is going to go out of his way to do the opposite. And I can hardly think of exceptions. I mean, usually that's such an absolutist statement, but I can hardly think of exceptions to that general rule. And so whether that's undoing all the multilateral frameworks, which also coincide with Trump's hostility to alliances and so forth, or, you know, just domestic policies that even people in Trump's own inner circle thought were good for the economy, he would still undo them if they were branded in any way with Obama. Some of it stems, again, I think, to who Donald Trump is and his insecurities that display themselves in all kinds of vivid and disturbing ways. But some of it has to do with, I think, some of the issues surrounding the 2016 election, the sense of never quite having that legitimate win. It was all way, you know, from the minute of the, you know, in the transition, you know, given some of what Trump's closest advisors were doing with the Russian Federation, the conversations they were having, which I agree we should not get into, but, you know, that was already out before inauguration even happened. And the reports of Russian interference, which were so overwhelming, you know, and which had been kind of arguably underplayed before the election, from the transition then into the new year of Trump's first year, that was a huge part of the story. Then the impeachment inquiry. And so this sense of illegitimacy and then a desire to shoot the predecessor, shoot the messenger, shoot those who were in office and who he blames for fueling that perception of his presidency in the mainstream. But it's Trump's own, you know, actions. I mean, look at the number of people in his campaign who've been indicted on criminal charges because of the actions that they undertook with a foreign government, including.
And yet, I mean, we make that sort of a theme. And yet, who knows? He might get elected in later this year. I want to talk to you about Hillary.
Absolutely.
Because yeah. I curled up and died in a ball on your behalf when I read the chapter entitled "Monster." For those who don't know what happened, just tell us about that incident and how you came back as a very, you know, as a public figure from what must have been a personally very humiliating thing. And it's sort of like you were in Dublin at the time when it all unfolded for you.
Yeah, thanks for that. I guess I brought it on myself by airing it. I felt I had to write about it because I tried in the book to think, what, you know, of so much happens in one's life, but what are the stories that have a larger resonance? And I think you put your finger on the one that and it matters for now, right? It's resilience. It's what we all kind of need in this chapter. But I was flying very close to the sun, and every time I'm flying close to the sun, I have a sneaking suspicion I'm about to crash to the ground. And I did at that time have that feeling as well, but it didn't stop me from being sloppy or reckless even. So I was you know, had I was working on my first political campaign for Barack Obama. He was doing way better than expected. He was the front runner against Hillary Clinton in the primary process. I had met my now husband, Cass Sunstein, canvassing in Iowa for Obama. As my book details, I had a pretty skimpy romantic life prior to that, or an unsatisfying one at least. And suddenly I had this relationship with great promise. I was an advisor to a potential Democratic nominee, if not a potential future president. I was getting to put my ideas where my mouth was. Ideas, I've just been an activist in the past, but actually to be engaging with Senator Obama, who was taking him seriously. And I went first, I had a book that was coming out that was very well received, and I went to the United Kingdom first, and I was in one of those windowless hotel rooms where reporters kind of stream through and you don't quite know, you're talking from one to the next, and you're, of course, I thought they were all interested in me for my ideas and my book, but all they cared about was Barack Obama. So I was answering, they were trying to pivot, steer it back to this book that I was trying to promote, and they were asking about Barack Obama or Barack Obama. So I went through the day of interviews, I didn't think anything about it, and then came to Dublin. I arrived at Dublin Airport. Say again?
To a burgeoning media storm, was it?
Well, not yet. No, I was going to continue to play up the Icarus thing, but I know I'm probably going on too long. But I have to share this. I arrive and I get a text message from Bono. You know, I wish I could say as one does. I don't get text messages from Bono as a general rule. It was my first ever text wanting to have a drink at the Shelburne. And so this was how close to the sun I was flying temporarily. So I meet Bono, I have a day in Dublin, you know, it's like a coming home. Because my parents split up, both sides of my family, a bit estranged in certain ways, but like me coming back on this successful book tour, which was rendered more successful by my affiliation with Obama more than my book, but it brought both halves of my family together. It was a very, very meaningful day, actually, just as it happened in my life. And I get back, I have the drink, and Brian Eno stops by. It's just one of these... this doesn't happen. And next thing the phone rings and it's the campaign and they say, did you call Hillary Clinton a monster? And I said, no, absolutely not. No way. I love Hillary Clinton. She's amazing. And if it weren't for Barack Obama, I'd be working, I hope, for her at this point. And then they read me these excerpts from an interview that allegedly had been given while I was in England with the Scotsman. And I said, I didn't even go to Scotland. Bullshit. This is all made up. This is right wing blah blah. It was on Drudge. And then Brian Eno, after I hung up, he said, are you sure? And I said, I didn't go to Scotland. I love Hillary. There's no way. And then I remembered through the cobwebs of my brain from 48 hours before that while I was in the middle of an interview, a friend of mine had called me and that Hillary's campaign had taken out an attack ad that featured this college friend of mine who was also on the campaign, Austin Goolsbee, and that I had been really, really angry and kind of swore and said, oh, it's terrible, and here's what you should do. He was calling me for media advice. He didn't realize I was about to implode on the national stage as a poster child for villain. But I had let loose with him on the phone, and then I came back and sat down with the reporter. Our interview was over, I thought, and I just continued to vent and use this hyperbolic, horrible word. And so that was it. There I was, you know, I forget what day of the week it was, but in Dublin, in my hotel room, having just had drinks with Bono and Brian Eno, and it all came crashing down. And little did I know that I knew Cass was flying to Ireland to spend the weekend with me and to meet my family for the first time. We'd only been dating a couple months, but I didn't know he had a ring in his pocket. So he was flying over to propose, thinking this was going to be this great weekend. And when he arrived, he was greeted by this catatonic creature that was me, just feeling terrible. I mean, above all, that Hillary could think that I would think these things. But then it all unfolded where, for a brief period, I was in denial. I thought maybe I could get through my Irish stint without anybody knowing. And I was on Pat Kenny's show, and somebody called in, and there I was talking about my book and Obama and everything all, and pretending to be happy. And someone called in and said, is this the same Samantha Power who slandered Hillary Clinton? And I kind of put my head in my hands and I said, I wish there were two of us, one an imposter and one who had done this terrible thing and one me, but it's just me and yes. And so I had to resign the campaign while in Dublin. So my coming home and my seeing my old Mount Anvil friends, it was all shattered by this infamy that I brought on myself. But if there's a lesson in it,
you got it. And you did get a chance to meet with Hillary Clinton. And the reason why I mentioned it is, you know, and you should read that chapter because it is a happy ending where Barack Obama says, look, you, when he brought you back, he said you were never off the team. You were just taking a break to find true love. The reason why I asked you about it is because one of the things we regularly discuss at Women for Election is the things that prevent women going forward in politics, whether it's to stand or whether to be actively involved as an advisor. And when I read in the book about the scrutiny, the vetting process that you had to go through when essentially Obama said to you, look, if there's anything involving sex, drugs or taxes in your life, I need to know, and the scrutiny that you went under. And indeed, one of the things we do at Women for Election is kind of put women through that process of, you know, literally when you have to sit down and think about your past. Have you any top tips? Because I have so many questions here, I'm going to be killed if I don't get to some of them. But have you any top tips for what it's like to be under that glare of scrutiny and to come through it in circumstances where women get scrutinized, I still believe, much, much more than their male counterparts?
First of all, I totally agree with the premise of the excess scrutiny. I mean, you mentioned I got a husband out of it sort of like that, but I do think that women have an advantage in that scrutiny, or can have an advantage, but not all of us take advantage of the advantage we have, which is, you know, the sisterhood, the solidarity, what you all are building and growing, with this network is so, and not just that network, but also the personal networks that each of us bring. You know, the lesson of that whole experience to me, I had never made myself vulnerable like I did to Cass. And I would not have probably if everything hadn't fallen apart. I was always work, 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 and one's foot in front of the other and the next professional, you know, goal and out of reach idea of mine was always going to be my focus. And I did learn with that vulnerability how important it was to just own that. And that it isn't it was a sign of weakness at that time, but in general, to admit that you need help is not a sign of weakness. So that would be point one. I think the second, which I can't say I'm all that good at myself, but boy, we've got to get better at it, is, you know, the old expression, when you're in a bad relationship, you know, it's not you, it's them. if we could internalize that it really is them, that it is the political culture, that you know, it's just, you're just an excuse for them maybe to go after your party or to go out, you know, and you're the latest bright, shiny object that they are focusing on. I mean, somehow to develop that thicker skin. I think men, in my experience, it may be different again in your world, but I think men are better at that, you know, just saying F them and they're, you know, sort of the same thing that I think makes us actually good at hearing criticism and internalizing it and trying to grow can make some of us at least worse at seeing that it really isn't about you, and sort of, you know, I hate to lose what can be wonderful about women coming to public life for the first time, which is a degree of authenticity and genuineness. But building a little bit of distance, I think, you know, can be helpful. And then the other thing is, you know, just from an early age, kind of thinking to yourself, what's the worst? And I'm not saying so you like read the tea leaves and don't do certain things or don't take risks or anything like that. I live my life the same way again, despite having gone through everything. And I've been incredibly lucky. But, you know, you do in these days, and I think it's a little less in Ireland, but I know it's coming. But what is the absolute sort of least charitable interpretation that one can give? And then issue spot ahead of time. And I think that's what's so great about this network, doing that so that you're armed and you learn. I mean, I have a chat actually, you know, I have that story in the book of Marco Rubio, just knowing, you know, I was saying that America should apologize. I wrote something where that America should apologize for crimes that it has committed, abetted, et cetera. something every Irish person would agree with. But I knew I was going to have to be subjected, and I became very superficial, which for many of us is really hard, but you sometimes have to do that because that's how superficial what's coming at you is.
It's really interesting. For anybody who's listening who has not read that part of the book, Samantha amassed what she describes as murder boards, people who came in before her scrutiny for the UN to stress test you, to throw all those questions at you. And I thought that that was a brilliant, a very vivid description, but a brilliant thing to do to kind of, and it's one of the things that we provide. You spoke about vulnerability, and there's one I want to talk to you about. As someone who, and many people on this call will know, I've spoken about my own fertility journey and the difficulties of that. And I look at your book and the numbers are amazing. 4 rounds of IVF, 4 miscarriages, 70 embryos, and now these 2 beautiful children that you have. And you were already in office in those roles, kind of running out of kind of, you know, highly secure units with your little kind of the pea on a stick, kind of trying to work that out. What was it like trying to have a family and then trying to raise a family when there are so few women at that level of global and national security?
Yeah, I mean, so first of all, to say I was lucky in the sense that Declan came easy and naturally, and so first, but with him, I was pregnant when I went to the White House for the first time. It was my first real government job, and my water broke in an argument, it looks like, with President Obama over whether to recognize the Armenian Genocide. So my son Declan was born a month early on Armenian Genocide Remembrance Day. So that's one example of life and work coinciding, just the tension and the heat of the argument. It was one of my, I mean, Obama would say the same, one of our least pleasant sort of exchanges where tempers flared. And, you know, I went back to the office very upset, you know, really, really upset about what had happened, but also about the nature of the conversation. And then I felt, I realized that I was like soaking wet and rushed to the hospital and had a baby. So that was, you know, just working till the last minute, wanting and not knowing it was the last minute, thinking I had another month. On the IVF itself, I think there was a transformative, ameliorative thing that happened through that process. I mean, first, of course, what precedes IVF is just the months and years of trying and failing to have a second child. And when you do get pregnant and you begin to visualize, because we've been so lucky with our first, you begin to visualize the siblings and the this, and then with miscarriages, you know, once you deign to dream, I'm very good usually at expectation management, but I got overconfident, not once but several times, and then finally, you know, got to the point of always expecting the worst and being unbelievably pleasantly surprised in the end after all those rounds. But the transformative moment was, which I write about a little bit in the book, but just was a female colleague of mine who actually was the person that I had sparred with on the Armenian Genocide, I think just by coincidence. We sparred on many issues, but she was one of 6 women at this very high level out of 26 so-called senior directors running our national security process. She was one of 6, and she, one day after my son was born, kind of convened the other women at the National Security Council. And, you know, where you convene our offices in those days, they're safes, they're actual safes. So it's like a spin dial, because and all the windows are closed because the spying and the, so it's a national security environment. And we come in and there's a bottle of wine, and Liz, who'd been around, she'd worked at the Pentagon and in other places and was a really seasoned pro. She said, "We're having this meeting and I want to hear about how all you ladies are doing." And so it all tumbled forth, you know, and it wasn't that session by any means that I, confessed to my fertility woes and how much trouble I was having, but as the trust grew up and we started doing this every week, and I coined in the, or I adopted the phrase in the book, not lean in, but lean on, these women, I mean, this little oasis in this safe with this wine, you know, sometimes for half an hour only, once a week. Sometimes we couldn't do it because we were traveling. But eventually then I began to talk about what I was going through. And of course, each of them, I mean, this is the thing, is we keep all of our pain and our vulnerability buried, and then we miss the opportunity to know that so many other people have had the same experience. And that's what I've learned with the book. That's why I put it out there in the book, is to say, none of us are alone. No, none of us are experiencing these things for the first time. So, you know, I would be leaving the Situation Room in the middle of a crisis meeting on Libya. And, you know, I'd be so embarrassed that I was leaving. You feel like you have the spotlight effect. Everybody's looking, and why is she shirking her duties, not telling anybody where I was going? And then I would spot one of the people from the so-called Wednesday group, and they'd give me the thumbs up and you know, wish me luck. And it was a game changer.
You mentioned Libya. And I know when we had these discussions, when we spoke last year for the BBC, and indeed everywhere you go, you get asked, there's an inevitability about the next questions, and it dominates a lot of the questions that are coming through on my little screen here. And it is about Libya, but most predominantly about Syria. And once again, you were home, I think you were home in Waterville, when the terrible news of the chemical weapons being used and all of those children who were killed in Syria. And this, I suppose, is one of the things which the Obama administration, and by extension your involvement with it and at the UN level, is judged. You ask yourself a question, and many thanks to Valerie or to whoever it is out there who sent me in this. She actually referred me to page 377 of your book. But, you know, did I inadvertently, through my presence, enable bad policy on a profoundly important issue? Should I have resigned once I became convinced that President Obama would not take my advice and change his disastrous course? The red lines were so well articulated, so well put out there, and in the end, Assad is still free to treat his people in that manner.
Yeah, I mean, I'm looking at the quote in the chat as well from the book. I tried to grapple with this and show why, notwithstanding having built my writing career at least on writing about mass atrocity and America's responsibilities, but why I didn't really, despite calls for my resignation, that I didn't come close to resigning. And I hope I do it in a way that isn't defensive or whatever. I think there are two main reasons that this was not a close call for me, even though I thought the calls for my resignation were completely fair, and I probably would have been issuing them for myself if I were on the outside. So how do I square that? I mean, first, you mentioned Libya. It's not as if I had up my sleeve for Syria, or probably anybody on this call or anybody in the national security establishment in America had up their sleeve some silver bullet for Syria. It wasn't as if with, you know, and this was different than Bosnia, where I'd cut my teeth as a rookie reporter back in the day, but it wasn't as if when I would come home at night to Cass and just lament how unsuccessful I had been or unpersuasive or inarticulate I had been in the Situation Room with the president. It wasn't as if I could say with, and if you just listen to me, I know we could end this war, right? I mean, the risks of going further than Obama did, and there's no excuse. I mean, I'm not trying to excuse issuing the red line threat. You know, you when you issue threats, that's a sort of different circumstance. But to insofar as I don't think that was well advised to use that term and to be so specific, absent a willingness to do a set of things. But on the question of whether those things should have been done or whether I should have resigned because they weren't done, you know, to think about, again, the U.S. military getting involved militarily in another Middle Eastern country, Libya went as well as it could have, in part because the whole world was united behind it with Security Council resolution in support of what was done, with Libyans on the ground rising up because of every Gaddafi had alienated the world and, you know, most Libyans. But then because of that lack of infrastructure in the wake of the intervention and the unwillingness of Libyans or the opposition of Libyans to having any international presence, you know, it devolved into what we see today, which is more heartbreak and more pain and so forth. And so when contemplating that next thing where a civilian protection zone, a no-fly zone, any of the kinds of things that I might have been drawn to, it's about bombing Assad. It's about, again, doing what was done in Libya. And so it's not as if I mean, I still think that given 500,000 deaths, mass population into Europe, use of chemical weapons, that population movement affecting the Brexit vote, you know, and changing Europe forever in terms of the rise of illiberal population, I still think President Obama should have absorbed more risk and been willing to try, especially after the red line moment, But it's not said with dogmatism and with a sense of, and therefore, you know, Syria would have been fixed. So that's one thing. And then if I could just briefly, a second point is, and this is alluded to, I think, in the question, which is worded very fairly, but I did have this amazingly broad portfolio. And so while I wasn't within the four corners of U.S. Syria policy getting what I wanted, I was UN ambassador, so I was able to negotiate with the Russians to get humanitarian aid into northern Syria and use my friendship and ties with different ambassadors to get political prisoners out of jail in various countries.
It did not impress your young son, Declan, who was sick and tired of you talking about Putin, Putin, Putin. I love that little anecdote. I think I've got about 7 minutes left, so I'm going to give you a series of quick-fire, rapid-round questions.
Okay.
So many issues. Right.
Brevity, not my strength, but I will do my best.
Let's go. So we're going to try and do these rapid-fire because there are so many things. I just want to like keep you on like for another hour, but let's go. So Ireland, what do you think Ireland's chances are of getting a seat on the UN Security Council?
Don't have my finger on the pulse. Would be amazing if I were there helping. tough competition. It's Ireland, Germany, Canada, right? It's the three for the two seats. But I think the small country, I'm hopeful small island states, small country affinities. There are a lot of them in the 193 countries in the UN. And being in the race, you know, as long as Ireland has, I'm hoping also that there'll be some respect for the commitments that were made. But there's a lot of money in play in these races, and that can be a hard thing to overcome. But fingers crossed.
This is going to be important for you to answer short, but you have to think of your murder board. What do you predict will be the next chapter in the book of China and international relations?
An ambition for complete domination. I have a very dark set of concerns, rendered darker by what has been written about in the chat, the complete retreat of U.S. leadership. So I think what you saw at the World Health Assembly this week shows that it can have a positive effect. President Xi wanting to show that China is now leading the world and doing a great thing, announcing $2 billion for a vaccine for developing countries. I mean, we should all celebrate that, but watch how China uses its leverage with the countries who get the vaccine to try to chip away at human rights norms at the United Nations. Watch.
One of the parts in the book which made me cry, and particularly when I listened to the audiobook version, because I'm really sorry, Samantha, I spilt a pint of water over your book and then left out in the sun. So it's now three times its normal size. But I listened to the audiobook and you talk about when Professor John Crown, the renowned cancer surgeon here, spoke about your dad. And I don't know how many times the word Hardigans appears in the book, but one of the questions I have, because so many families in Ireland have been blighted by alcohol, have you made peace with your dad and the life he led and sadly the death that he had?
The book helped. You know, in a funny way, I think when a big rupture like us leaving Ireland and then my father dying, what to me was very suddenly, to those who knew him, you know, also I think sudden, because, you know, people in their 40s, even who have a problem with the drink, that's unusual, even with alcoholism, for that to happen. And so it was a very sudden thing. And so another huge rupture. The temptation is to burrow and to suppress. And I did that pretty well. And I think I kept in motion. I think my mother kept in motion, keeps in motion. She's on the front lines on COVID at Mount Sinai Hospital in New York. Amazing woman. But just full speed ahead. That's the Power Delaney way. And that's what we did. And I think for me I felt also so lucky that my mother was still alive and doing her best as to parent my brother and me, that I felt guilty kind of opening all of that up over the years. And so I didn't ask a lot of questions and I didn't get a lot of answers because I didn't ask them, because she wasn't volunteering. So the book gave me an excuse, almost like a reporter, to go back into my own life and to really delve into talking to my dad's girlfriend, his sister, his wonderful sister, And so I think I have more of a sense than I would have ever been able to get otherwise of just how bad it was. The thing that kids tell themselves is, if I had been worth more, then he could have got his act together, you know. I read Fergal Keane's great book, Wounds. I don't know how many of you read that. It's beautiful on this subject. Or actually, sorry, it was his other memoir. It was beautiful on the subject of his dad. And again, we all tell ourselves that if we were something else, they could do it. And you know, as an adult, going back over all of that, you get just a much thicker sense of what the drink is and what the disease is and how much bigger it is than any of us. So in that sense, you know, yes, but you know, the regrets don't go away. The loss, the wish you could go back in time, you know, that desire to revise history lives strong in me. I just now have more history I would wish to revive, including the 2016 election.
It's like a constant thread and ribbon throughout the book. And I wanted to sit down with your mom and talk about her taking that case in the Supreme Court back then. It was just amazing what she did. Last two questions. What do you most regret and what are you most proud of? What is Samantha Power, not with an S? I was very careful to make sure I didn't call you Samantha Powers, but what are you most proud of and what do you regret? What would you go back and change and what are you really, really proud of? And professionally or personally?
I think that the sort of, I'll tell a brief story because somebody asked about Biden and I know we're in a hurry, but you know, I write in the book about...
We have the time if you have, Samantha, so...
I'm all for... Irish, my fellow Irish women, I have the time, but I know people are going to have to drop. But the... I made a point when I was in the government, and I'm proud of this. You know, I never, with very few exceptions, I never pulled my punches. You know, I never kind of gamed it out and thought, will I come across as overly soft, or, you know, have I said this before? You know, and I think I never gave up. And so there were a lot of issues that were pretty overdetermined in a non-human rights friendly way, not because of Barack Obama as such, but, you know, not every decision goes to him. The sort of systemic pulls and gravity that you'd imagine in American foreign policy were pretty profound. And so, but to just be relentless in that way. And with Obama, despite, you know, my respect for him, you know, if I had something on my mind, by and large, spitting it out, saying it, leaving it there. And he got irritated with me a number of times, many more than I write about in the book, and yet always wanted me in the room, which distinguishes him from the current president, as Obama just welcomed dissent and debate and thought he was better for it. But occasionally he'd get a little pissy and and would sort of shoot me down and, you know, oh, we've all read your book, Samantha, you know, or, you know, you trying to convince me that Syria is a shit show? That's what you're trying to convince me? You think I need help being convinced, you know, that kind of thing. And almost, when I was in the room, sometimes I was zooming in on video, but when I was in the room, as I often was in Washington, if there was ever one of those moments, I'd say a couple of things. First, Obama would almost invariably come back to me 5 or 10 minutes later, knowing that he kind of screwed up and that if he undermined me in a group setting, that people would be all too happy not to ignore my human rights advocacy, happy to ignore my human rights advocacy in future meetings. So he would try to recover. But the second point is, in the interim, before he'd have had a chance to rehabilitate me, having swatted me down, I would get a note in the Situation Room. And the note, I'd say this happened maybe 10 times, I mean, a lot. And the note was always from Joe Biden. And the note was usually some version of, go Irish, you go Irish, or go girl, or never be quiet, never be silent. And it says a lot, I think, about Joe Biden. But I am proud to have left it all kind of in the ring, as they say. I mean, just, I did not give up. And I think, in terms of my regret, I mean, I wouldn't do it differently, but I will not get those years back with my kids. You know, it's just a fact. And so as we can circle back to where we started, you know, I am struggling with the homeschooling mightily, but To have these days, these longer days to be, I've learned to cook, I can show you, I have a burn on my hand. It's just this week's burn. Every week is a new, I forget that things are where they're not supposed to be because I'm usually ordering takeout, but to be there, to have family dinners, to be able to do that. I mean, I think to binge in one's life professionally is great, but to get to binge personally, I feel really lucky to be able to kind of at least chip away at that loss of that time, which, because time is the most precious commodity.
My final question, which you might maybe just impart as advice. One is, will you run for politics? If not, why not? And what advice do you have to women on this call who perhaps don't want to run, but do want to get more actively involved in politics? We could speak forever about your you had the big chapter kind of on the shrink and everything, but
yeah.
Why are you going to run? Are you going to run for politics? Could we see a president-elect power? That'd be great.
I'm Irish. I can't be president or vice president for that matter.
Would you run for anything else? Would you recommend running for election?
I would recommend running, and I would love to run. I would either love to run or I'd love to go back into public service in some other way. But I am, just to the point I just made, I am in a phase where I'm trying to make up for an awful lot of lost time. So I'm going to try to stay disciplined. But I to be in public service, I mean, I've been really lucky. I was a war correspondent, a journalist, a columnist, a human rights activist, a professor. I mean, what an embarrassment of riches of having gotten to sample all these careers. And nothing was as meaningful as being in public office of sorts. Now, it's not the same as, in a way, I didn't make myself vulnerable in the way that you all who have run for office have done. And I respect that so much, because you risk losing, you risk people saying no when you're asking for money, if you have to do that there as well, or asking for your vote. You risk that. You risk so much hate and misogyny also these days in the cyber world, which is very concentrated here, but I think, you know, certainly Ireland's not immune to that, I know. And if you risk all of that, it's extremely brave, but the reward, I think the feeling that one has of having tried, that's sort of a little bit what I was saying about my time in the Obama administration, even on the causes where I you know, there are many where I feel like I did make a mark and was able to use the U.S. foreign policy machine for good for people around the world whose voices are often not heard, which is why I stayed in the government, notwithstanding Syria. But even on Syria, to just on January 17th, I think I was still pushing for some ceasefire proposal, you know, to never give up. And I think running for office, and even when it doesn't work out, that feeling of I put it out there is a really important feeling. And so, consistent again with other obligations, the reward to have a hand in affecting your community in these ways, it's such an Irish thing, actually, just to be a politician, you know, the gift of the gab, of course, but also the listening, the quality of attention, I think, Irish women in particular have and offer people it's a very adaptive quality in running for office. And if you don't run, or if you can't run because you have childcare obligation or other things, there are so many ways and to believe in a candidate. I mean, I had that experience too. I never met a politician. Barack Obama, of course, is singular in many ways, but there are people like that at every level, right? Who you just think, they just have my value. They are, I can't do it right now because I'm in homeschooling hell. But that person, you know, if I can canvas for that person, knock on doors, put up signs, ring doorbells when we can ring doorbells again, you know, that, give money, I mean, to support that and then to see the return on your investment when you see that person standing for what you stand for and you know you've had a hand in their election, it's so powerful. And I'm in the midst of that now, not just with Joe Biden, but we have to, if we're going to do any of the recovery that we need after this disaster here of the last few years, we have to take the Senate. And so it's not enough. And you know, we lost in the Obama years, state legislatures, governorships, we have to take those back. And so we're much more alert now at the range of ways to make a difference. You know, I was always, as a foreign policy person, I was necessarily focused on the federal and the national level. but the number of pockets of influence, climate change being dealt with at the community level. You know, pandemic response is now managed so much at the community level by particular districts. So there are so many layers of influence and for influence, and I just admire all of you for thinking about it, for helping others put themselves forward, and for putting your hats in the ring yourselves. Well, look, let me know if I can help.
Yeah. Well, look, before I hand over, well, you've helped hugely and immensely just by being so generous, and I know I've taken up more of your time than I had intended. Thank you so much. It has been an absolute pleasure. Hold on to a book for me and sign it again, because this one's busted. But we know how much Ireland means to you. We know that you will be home again soon, and hopefully we will get that in-person meeting, and we will get to see you for future Women for Election events. But right. I'm going to hand back to Corinne, but to everyone who has been all these thank you messages are flooding in, but it's been an absolute privilege, Samantha Power, and I will hand you back to Kieran in, is it our Kerry studio, or are we still in the capital?
Still in Dublin, unfortunately. I'm also in North County Dublin, so we can call these the joint North County Dublin studios. Thanks a million to both of you. I mean, it's such a conversation ranging from the pandemic to presidential campaigns to the personal international diplomacy. And I think it was really refreshing as well when you were asked, you know, will you run? You say, I'd love to run. To hear somebody saying it so clearly as well, it's just great to hear. You may regret saying you're here to help, because after that we will pick you up on it. I'm very conscious of your time, so I'm not going to keep you any longer. Just to say again, thank you to both Samantha Power and Dervin McDonald. You've both been brilliant.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks again to Samantha Power and Dervin McDonald for joining us today. As always, please do share the podcast. And again, if you can donate to Women for Election, please go onto our website, womenforelection.ie.